In the summer of 1961, a young seminary student grappled with a doctrine that would transform his life and ministry forever. The doctrine? The sovereignty of God. Today, on Insight for Living, Chuck Swindoll teaches from an Old Testament passage that in 1961 ignited his understanding of God's authority in all things. Daniel chapter 4 tells the story of a proud king who had to learn through dramatic circumstances that, quote, "The Most High rules over the realm of mankind." If you miss any portion of our last program, we'll begin with helpful highlights. Our topic today is God's sovereignty.
I think not until we embrace God's sovereignty will we have the ability to reason theologically. Until then, we will be too important in the plan. Man's opinion will be too significant to us. And we will churn and wrestle and struggle our way through this Christian life rather than living it relieved and, if I may, relaxed in His plan. On your way back to the book of Job, stop off in Proverbs 21, just the first verse. Proverbs 21, verse 1. The king's heart is like channels of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wishes. Isn't that great? We look upon these great kings and these great presidents and these great governors and these great mayors and these men of state and these men and women of significant importance internationally, and we suck in our breath in awe. And yet God is able to move their hearts like His finger would reach down and retrace the destiny of a river. It's no problem to Him. He moves it wherever He wishes. And He isn't through doing that. And I might add, it isn't limited to kings. It's true of you and me. Now, that's hard for you if you're a proud person, especially if that pride is connected with stubbornness. Usually they go together. You resist that thought because you see the fear of its going to seed, and I understand. In fact, you can name some people who have gone through some awful times, and you say, "You're telling me that God smiled on that? That He was responsible for that? That He allowed that?" Well, let's take an example from Job. Turn back. Remember Job? Let's locate chapter 38. Here is a man who lost everything but wife and life. Children, home, livestock, servants, bankroll, everything. Lost his health. His body was covered with oozing skin ulcers from the crown of his head to the sole of his feet. I can't imagine such pain. And on top of that, he had to listen to the talk of Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar and Elihu, so-called friends, who came to lecture him on why he was getting what he was due. And he sat through that. And he listened. Finally, God spoke to Job. Chapter 38. He breaks the silence. He comes in and he addresses Job personally. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. That's the way the Lord saw all that counsel before He stepped on the scene. Ever been in a place like that? Ever been in a quandary and then you've had people volunteer their counsel and push their advice and drop little letters on you or phone calls, and it's conflicting and it's confusing and it's anything but comforting? It's a whirlwind. And you long to hear God's pristine message. I have in my notes, read chapters 38, 39, 40, and 41. But we haven't the time for all of that. So I'm going to pick and choose my way through this section. This is a great section where God says to Job, "I am in charge. I know what I'm doing. My way is right. pain, suffering, and all, I am reigning sovereign over you. Here's a series of rhetorical questions that he asks Job. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you instruct me. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, if you have understanding. Who sets its measurements, since you know? Who stretched the line on it? On what were its bases sunk? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy, who enclosed the sea with doors? When bursting forth, it went out from the womb. When I made a cloud its garment, and thick darkness its swaddling band, and I placed boundaries on it, and I set a bolt and doors, and I said, thus far you shall come, but no farther. And here shall your proud waves stop. Have you ever in your life commanded the morning, Job? Ever caused the dawn to know its place? Ever brought one sun onto the skies? Ever made it happen that it might take hold the ends of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? It is changed like clay under the seal, and they stand forth like a garment. And from the wicked their light is withheld, and the uplifted arm is broken. Have you entered into the springs of the sea? Have you walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been revealed to you, or have you seen the gates of deep darkness, Job? Have you understood the expanse of the earth? Tell me if you will know all of this. Where is the way to the dwelling of light? And darkness, where is its place, Job? That you may take it to its territory, that you may discern the paths to its home. Verse 22, have you entered the storehouses of the snow? Have you seen the storehouses of the hail, which I have reserved for the time of distress? You ever seen that in the scriptures? Our newspapers report disaster strikes, blizzard sweeps across the North Midwest, and we say, what a tragedy. God says, I had my storehouses already, and I sent the snow. Yes. Either that or he is partially sovereign. He is almost in control, which is a strange way to put it. That's like my being almost a husband or almost a father. You are or you are not. He goes on to talk about it. Verse 31, look at this. Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you lead forth a constellation in its season and guide the bear with her satellites? He's talking about the stars, the constellations above us. You have any control over that? No, I can make lenses that help me see it, but I can't change the direction of it. I can go wow on occasion. I can stand back in amazement, but I can't change the movement. Do you know the ordinances of the heavens are fixed their rule over the earth? Look at chapter 39. Look at 39:19. Do you give the horse its might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make him leap like the locust? His majestic snorting is terrible. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his strength. He goes out to meet the weapons. He laughs at fear and is not dismayed, and he does not turn back from the sword. Describes that further. Verse 26, is it by your understanding that the hawk soars, stretching his wings toward the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? Job listens to all of this. Look at 41, verse 1. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? The Leviathan represented the denizens of the deep, these great, huge creatures, the monsters of the deep. Or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make supplications to you, or will he speak to you soft words? He goes on asking all of these questions all the way through these chapters. And finally, Job hears enough. Verse 1, chapter 42. Then Job answered, and he said, I know that thou canst do all things, and that no purpose of thine can be thwarted. Job got 4 years seminary education in 3 chapters. He got it all. He dumped the truck on Job. Job says, I've got it. I got it. I see it. I see it's clear. It's clear. No purpose of thine can be thwarted. Remember that. Don't scissor that out of your Bible. Leave it there. When God says it shall be done, it will be done. If it makes me unhappy, if it makes me unhappy. If it hurts, if it hurts. If it ruins my reputation, if it ruins my reputation, God says it shall be done, and his purpose will not be thwarted, or he is not sovereign. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I've declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Hear now, I will speak. I will ask thee, and do thou instruct me. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee. And look at his final response. I retract. I repent. I lay down my arms. I repent in dust and ashes. You want to know who's in charge around here? The one who called the spaces into being. The one who put the clouds in place. The one who established the atmosphere in which we're able to live, the one who put the seas and the dry land, who gave you breath for your lungs, the ability to think, the one who placed you here now in time for his purpose, and the one who, with a snap of his finger, will pull you from life into eternity. He's in charge. How does his resume read? He must see the end from the beginning. Whoever is sovereign must have total, clear perspective. He must have no match on earth or heaven. He must entertain no fears, no ignorance, and have no needs. He must have no limitations and always know what is best. He must never make a mistake. He must possess the ability to bring everything to a purposeful conclusion and an ultimate goal. He must be invincible, immutable, infinite, and self-sufficient. His judgments must be unsearchable and his ways unfathomable. He must be able to create rather than invent, to direct rather than wish, to control rather than hope, to guide rather than guess, to fulfill rather than dream. And that's just a half page of my thoughts. That's our God. The one who says, it shall be and it is done, and it shall not be and it is not done. How often we puny human beings speak as though we are in charge and we are free. William Wordsworth, in a piece entitled Prelude, the early part of the piece talks about how wonderful it was for him to escape the city where he had been pent up so long. And now he says, I am free, free as a bird to settle where I will. Free as a bird? As a bird? One theologian writes, the naturalist knows that the supposedly free bird actually lives its entire life in a cage made of fears, hungers, and instincts. It is limited by weather conditions, varying air pressures, the local food supply, predatory beasts, and that strangest of all bonds, the irresistible compulsion to stay within the small plot of land and air assigned it. The freed bird is, along with every other created thing, held in constant check by a net of necessity. Only God is free. You and I know nothing of freedom. Bound to a very particular climate, to a particular set of conditions in which we could survive at best, struggle most often. Bound by relationships, bound by hang-ups, bound by nature, relying on God for the very impulse that causes the heart to beat and the lungs to work and the body to move and the mind to think. Free? Really free? We strut as though we are free. But the matter of fact is, We are incredibly dependent people. God knows no such dependence. Only He occupies an unthreatened throne. He never will come close to meeting His match. Now, what does sovereignty mean? I see how it affected Job, but in the eyes of the Apostle Paul, who perhaps developed it as well as anyone in the 9th, 10th, and 11th chapters of Romans, what does he have to say about God's sovereignty? You must make your own study of Romans 9, 10, and 11. And if you don't struggle with the chapters, you're not really studying them. You'll think you have it all solved in chapter 9, and then you'll come upon chapter 10. And then you'll be struggling all over with what was said in chapter 9 in light of chapter 10. And then you finally come to a great doxology at the final four verses of chapter 11, where I'd like you to turn now, 11:33. And you'll perhaps, as I did, sigh with a sense of incomprehensible relief, leaving some of the mystery with God. Allow me the 33rd verse. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are His judgments and unfathomable His ways. Don't look up. Keep studying those words. This brilliant apostle, under the direction of the Spirit of God, presents the Lord, our Father, as being full of wisdom and knowledge. So whatever is sovereign, whatever is expressed in sovereignty, is bathed in wisdom and knowledge. When He makes His decisions, which are called here judgments, they are unsearchable because we live in a finite realm and He in an infinite. We live in the temporal now. He lives in the eternal forever. So His decisions, His judgments are unsearchable. And His ways, while they are right, are often unfathomable. You cannot get to the bottom of them. You come often to the place where you say, I just accept it. And that requires a humility. Hard for the educated, intelligent person of today. I've come up with a simple definition. Sovereignty means our all-wise, all-knowing God reigns in realms beyond our comprehension to bring about a plan beyond our ability to alter, hinder, or stop. Our all-wise, all-knowing God reigns in realms beyond our comprehension to bring about a plan beyond our ability to alter, hinder, or to stop. Let me go further. Let these thoughts flow freely through your mind. His plan includes all promotions and demotions. His plan would mean both adversity and prosperity, tragedy and calamity, ecstasy and joy. It would envelop illness as much as health, perilous times as much as comfort, safety, and ease. It would be at work when we cannot imagine why, because it is so unpleasant, as much as when the reason is clear and pleasant. His sovereignty, though it is inscrutable, would be over all handicaps, all heartaches, all helpless moments. It would be at work through all disappointments, broken dreams, and lingering difficulties. And even when we cannot fully fathom why, He knows. When we cannot explain the reasons, He understands. And when we cannot see the end, He is there, nodding, yes, that is my plan. Look further at the three verses that follow. Who knows the mind of the Lord? Who became His counselor? Who has first given to Him that it might be paid back to Him again? For from him and through him and to him are all things. If you want to alter sovereignty and make it temporal or limited, you've got to get rid of all things. Just as you must do that in Romans 8:28. If he says all things, he means it. And it is for his glory forever. According to this 36th verse, to him be the glory forever and ever. Our sovereign is the master and the mover. He is the giver and the receiver. He is the originator, for it says, from him. He is the enforcer, through him. He's the provider, to him, are all things. And lest we think of this as a blind, bitter fate, remember, it is for his greater glory forever. What does it not mean? Right about now, some of you are getting real nervous about me. You've already begun to plan the letter you want to write, saying, Chuck, I think you've gone off the deep end. This, like with Paul, much learning doth make thee mad. Let me put your mind at ease. It was the madness of that kind of extremism that kept me from embracing sovereignty. That was why the wrestling went on so long. And it isn't that I don't still at times wrestle. I do. But when this doctrine is taken to unbiblical extremes, hear me, people allow themselves to become passive, uninvolved, lacking in zeal, irresponsible, and not striving for personal excellence. All is of God. He does everything. I find it interesting that the apostle who writes this grand three-chapter declaration and ends it on such a high point, the zenith of it is the last four verses of chapter 11, comes immediately into chapter 12 and devotes the balance of the book of Romans to our responsibilities. You ever thought about that? The doctrine of the book is chapters 1 through 11, but when he gets to chapter 12, it's all duty. The very ones that he instructed, saying God is in control, God is in charge, God is sovereign, God is responsible. He says, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies. He doesn't tell God to present his body. The command is to the believer. Look at it. Verse 1, chapter 12. There's urgency. I urge you. By the mercies of God, I plead with you to present your bodies. There's responsibility. In fact, verse 2 says, don't do something. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You have a responsibility not to let the world around you squeeze you into its own mold. Oh, don't worry about that. I believe in sovereignty. Well, so does the one who wrote it. And he says it's our responsibility. In fact, there's activity in this passage. Look at chapter 12, verse 6. Since we have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, let each exercise them accordingly. If you have the gift of prophecy, then exercise it according to your faith. If it is service, then serve. Verse 7. If it's teaching, then teach. If it's exhortation, then exhort. Verse 8. If you have the gift of giving, then do it with liberality. If you are to lead, then do it with diligence. And if you show mercy, do it with cheerfulness. In fact, he even cares about relationships. He says, don't let your love be with hypocrisy. Verse 9, let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor what is evil. Cling to what is good. Be devoted to one another in brotherly love. One command after another. One imperative after another. And it goes on into chapter 13, into chapter 14, into chapter 15. Oh, yeah, we have a sense of responsibility. God's sovereignty does not mean that I'm released from responsibility. Does not mean I have no interest in today's affairs. I cannot be bothered about decisions. I need not concern myself with the eternal destiny of other people. Doesn't mean that at all. Somehow there has to be a balance.
There's much more on this topic that Chuck Swindoll wants to show us. He's talking about God's sovereignty, and this is Insight for Living. The sermon we feature today is number 4 in an 11-part study called The Mystery of God's Will. And as a compliment to this study, I want to point you to a practical book that Chuck's written that dovetails naturally with this topic. It's our featured resource right now, and it's called What If God Has Other Plans? You know, few things will test our faith more than an unexpected crisis. Things like a financial disaster, dealing with a disrespectful boss, betrayal by your best friend. These difficult moments expose our fears, our feelings of inadequacy, our insecurities. In his book, Chuck Swindoll addresses 11 complicated issues with 11 biblical answers. Today, we're pleased to offer Chuck's book, When You Step Forward to Become a Monthly Companion. It comes with our profound gratitude for your partnership. Let me give you some context for this important relationship with Insight for Living. As a monthly companion, you agree to send a monthly donation in the amount of your choice. When you do, you play a significant role in making this daily program available. If you think about it, when you first started listening to Chuck Swindoll teach on the Bible, that moment was sponsored by someone you never met. It was a monthly companion who sponsored you. And you can take that step today. To provide for someone else what was once provided to you, we invite you to become a monthly companion. And to thank you for your first-time donation as a monthly companion, we'll say thanks by providing a copy of Chuck's book, What If God Has Other Plans? One of our ministry reps will be glad to walk you through the process when you call us at 800-772-8888. Or become a monthly companion by following the simple instructions at insight.org/monthly-companion. I'm Bill Meyer, inviting you to join us when Chuck Swindoll continues his powerful study on the mystery of God's will, Monday on Insight for Living. The preceding message, Another Deep Mystery, God's Sovereignty, was copyrighted in 1987, 1988, 1994, 2000, and 2024, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2024 by Charles R. Swindoll, Incorporated. All rights are reserved worldwide. Duplication of copyrighted material for commercial use is strictly prohibited.